Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, this week we've got a number of different topics to talk about, and the show will be split, broadly speaking, into two parts. In the first part, you'll hear an interview that I conducted earlier today with Nicholas White. Now, Nicholas is an expert on politics and sophology in Northern Ireland. He's a visiting professor at the University of Belfast, and also a senior director at APCO Worldwide. And Nicholas was a chance find of mine when I tweeted out to followers on Twitter for advice on who I should approach about talking about Northern Ireland. Now, Northern Ireland is something that is close to my heart. My grandmother is from there, from County Down in Newry. And it's something that I've always been interested in sort of as a result, and very close sort of family ties to the province. And I do have a sort of personal concern that with all the Brexit discussions that are going on and the complications around that, that there is a chance Northern Ireland is forgotten. And although one would hope we don't end up back in the troubles of the 70s and 80s, and maybe that's unlikely because of what that would involve, we shouldn't take it for granted. And I certainly hope that the leaders in Westminster do not take it for granted. And I really wanted to do an episode looking at Northern Ireland and getting someone's expert thoughts on that. So I tweeted out to my followers and said, look, you know, who do you know that's good? And Nicholas's name came up sort of two or three times. So I thought he would be someone to speak to. So the first sort of 15 minutes or so of this episode is me speaking to him, getting his impressions on the upcoming Northern Irish elections, but also the future of Northern Ireland post-Brexit. In the second half of the show, I'll be joined by regular podcaster Leo Barassi. Now, Leo, this is the first time Leo's been on Polling Matters this year. He's writing a book on climate change called The Climate Majority, which we'll be talking about in future episodes, I'm sure. So he's been sort of off the scene in terms of this show, but he's back today. And we're going to be talking about the latest Polling Matters opinion poll, where we put a number of statements around leadership to the public and asked to what extent they agreed or disagreed that they applied to Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. And part of the project that we're trying to do with Opinium is to get underneath the skin of some of the headline numbers. You don't need us to tell you about voting intention. You don't need us to tell you about you know, favourability ratings or approval ratings of different leaders. Obviously, we discussed that on the show, but there's no real need for us to be doing our own polls on that. Where I think there might be more of a need is on some of the nuance and on some of the detail, and that's what we're doing today. There were six statements that we asked of Theresa May, and the same statements, slightly paraphrased for Jeremy Corbyn, slightly amended for Jeremy Corbyn, depending on what those statements were, and we asked on an agree or disagree scale whether people agreed or disagreed with them, but also they had the option of saying neither and don't know as well. And we'll be unveiling some of those results later on the show with me and Leo. But before I go into my interview with Nicholas White, it's probably worth touching on some of the latest on Donald Trump. Now, the weekend, I think it's fair to say, we're on Wednesday, it's Wednesday the 1st of February at the moment. The last weekend was a difficult one for Theresa May in the UK, given that her close relationship or a perceived close relationship with Donald Trump, she certainly seemed to cozy up to him last Friday when she was over in the States. Donald Trump's subsequent travel ban on on people from seven countries in the Middle East has been extremely controversial. It's prompted mass protests, not just in the US, but elsewhere as well. There's a huge protest in London. And Theresa May is under a lot of pressure. And I should add that it was over the weekend when we did our poll on Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, so do bear that in mind later on. But I thought it was worth mentioning a poll that I'd seen conducted by Ipsos in the States, which actually showed headline figures of 48% agreeing that with the executive order that President Trump signed. And the wording used was, do you agree or disagree with the executive order that President Trump signed blocking refugees and banning people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the US? 48% agreed with that and 41% disagreed. Now, there's more detail on that poll and some of the other questions that were asked in that poll online, and I've tweeted them out. and I can, I'm happy to do so again after this show. It is one finding, but it does show that actually the extent of opposition that we've seen on the streets and, in, and on, from the left is not necessarily reflected in the general population in the US as a whole. And one of the things I would say here is that that's an important thing to understand, that, you know, there are, there is this somewhat silent majority over in the States that maybe supports what Donald Trump is doing. But at the same time, we shouldn't simply about face when we hear these things and assume that because 48% agree with what he's doing, that somehow that makes it okay. I mean, this is an important point when we discuss polling. On the one hand, yes, you want to understand what public opinion is, but that doesn't necessarily mean you always cowtail to it. Sometimes you have to change course when the public is very much not on your side. But other times you have to change how you make your argument. And that is a subjective debate. You know, we're not always going to agree on when to do so. But it is interesting that the news media would give you the impression that everyone opposes what Donald Trump's doing. The polls suggest that's not necessarily the case. Does that mean you should stop opposing him? Maybe, maybe not. That's up to other people to decide. But there'll be more on Donald Trump later as I talk to Leo, I'm sure. So for now, let's kick off with this week's episode. I'll start with my interview with Nicholas White. We talked about Northern Ireland, and I started off by asking him to explain to people that are maybe less familiar with Northern Ireland what's going on there. So I'm here with Nicholas White, visiting professor at Ulster University and senior director at APCO Worldwide. Nicholas, thank you for joining me.
Kieran, thanks very much for having me.
So, Nicholas, we were talking off air about how I've done a little bit of background research, if you like, through my dissertation and also for having family in Northern Ireland. So I'm reasonably familiar with the inner workings of the Northern Ireland Assembly and the power sharing agreement. But I am conscious that not everybody that listens to this show will be. So I guess before we crack on, it'd be worth you just briefly explaining how the Northern Ireland Assembly elections work and what about the power sharing agreement we should probably be keeping in mind as we look ahead to the upcoming elections.
Sure, and it is a complex situation, and it is worth just running over the main points again for people who perhaps may not have paid a lot of attention since 1998, when the Good Friday Agreement was first signed, or indeed since the amendments that were made to it in 2006, which is already more than 10 years ago. So the Northern Ireland Assembly is elected by proportional representation, so each of the Westminster parliamentary seats will elect 5 members to the new assembly. That itself is a change because previously it was 6 from each of the 18 constituencies, so now it'll be 5. So the new assembly will have 90 seats rather than 108. From that assembly is then elected, first of all, a first minister and deputy first minister. The first minister comes from the largest of the political parties represented in the assembly. The deputy first minister comes from the largest party from the other side, as it were. So if a unionist party is the biggest party, then the largest nationalist party gets deputy first minister and vice versa. And then the parties in the assembly also elect a 7-member executive of ministers. And they are chosen proportionally from those parties that want to participate in the process. Last year, 3 of the smaller parties chose not to do it. So those 7 ministers all came from the 2 big parties, the DUP and Sinn Féin. And then also on top of that, the Minister of Justice is chosen by vote of the entire Assembly with approval from a majority of both nationalist and unionist members, as well as a majority of those voting. And at present, the outgoing holder of that post is an independent member of the Assembly elected from East Londonderry. On top of that, as if that was not complex enough, the Northern Ireland government is itself embedded in 2 other networks. One of them is that for some functions there is an All-Ireland consultative body, which is the power to regulate on issues that impact on both sides of the border. And also there is a Council of the Isles, which brings together the British Parliament, the British government, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, the Isle of Man, and the Channel Islands. And that meets, I think, once or twice a year. And doesn't do much more than overall coordination and conversation. But nonetheless, it's quite important to have a forum where all of these governments get together. So quite a lot hangs on the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement as it's been amended over the years.
And we obviously, any power sharing agreement lends itself to some degree of insecurity, and we have an election coming up in Northern Ireland. What's brought that about? There is this renewable heat incentive scheme which seems to have been extremely controversial, isn't there?
Yes, and in fact it turned out to be one of the unexpected consequences of devolution. In the rest of the UK, in England, Scotland and Wales, there was a very similar scheme, which essentially it compensated people who switched to renewable energy for heating of their homes or workplaces, and particularly of farm buildings. What happened in Northern Ireland was that for some reason, and this is what's still not clear, no cap was set on the maximum grant that you could expect to get from this scheme, whereas in the rest of the UK there was a cap. And also the rate of compensation was set a little higher, and then unexpectedly the price of the fuel actually dropped to the point that you were in fact not getting partial, but you were getting overcompensated, and it paid you to buy your renewable fuels and then to get the government to pay you back the same and more. Unintended consequences, but there you go. So that's a maladministration question. The answers that were given by the DUP ministers who were responsible were frankly not satisfactory to very many people. And it linked up with a steady erosion of trust between the DUP and Sinn Féin, which were the two parties in the government, over issues like how to deal with the legacy of the past, how to deal with the status of the Irish language, which was a commitment that has been made by the British government, but never by the DUP. In terms of what its legitimate uses could be in Northern Ireland. So all of that added up to a crisis of confidence, which was brought to a head by the resignation of Martin McGuinness last month as Deputy First Minister. And the rules are that if you do not have a viable First Minister, Deputy First Minister tandem in position, then there must be fresh elections, and that is what has happened.
And we have Michelle O'Neill on the Sinn Féin side stepping into Martin McGuinness's role, I understand. I mean, what do we know about her? I mean, obviously, huge political shoes to fill.
Well, she's, of course, relatively young as party leaders go in Northern Ireland. She's born in 1977, just celebrated her 40th birthday last month. And so she comes from the west of Northern Ireland, as does Arlene Foster. She's from Michelle O'Neill is from County Tyrone. Arlene Foster is from County Fermanagh. And although, of course, she's too young to have been involved in the Troubles herself, many of her family members were members of the IRA and were activists in Sinn Féin. So she comes from a fairly hard-line tradition. She has the family credentials. She has been in the Northern Ireland Assembly since 2007. In other words, since the St Andrews Agreement brought devolution back, it's clear that she has the confidence of the Sinn Féin leadership. A number of other names had been in the frame. We always knew that Martin McGuinness would have to retire someday. None of us lasts forever. And it's interesting that some of the other early runners and riders essentially receded into the background, and it's clear that she is the one who has the confidence of both the rank and file and of the leadership.
And what do you make of the Northern Ireland Secretary's comments recently, just getting those up here, around James Brokenshaw, around the Troubles inquiries not working, and about how they were too focused on sort of British forces and British troops and their actions in the province? I mean, presumably that has caused a lot of controversy within Sinn Féin.
Yes, and I mean, let's be really clear here. This is not a let's start from zero situation. This is a rebalancing of the historical equation. The fact is that during the Troubles, those terrorists on both sides who were caught were sent to jail, some of them for very long periods, and as part of the peace agreement, most of them, in fact almost all of them, were then released. But the fact is that British forces who also engaged in unlawful violence were hardly ever prosecuted, and when they were prosecuted, they were hardly ever convicted. So there is a historical inequality that really does need to be addressed. And of course, when inequalities are addressed, those who had benefited from the previous situation always feel upset, and will always point to the most recent events as if the clock had started ticking in 1998. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people, the clock on this started ticking a good deal earlier.
If we look ahead to the future, I mean, Arlene Foster has said that this election could be the most important since 1998. And I suppose politicians in every election do have a habit of over-dramatising. Every next election is always the most important for a generation. But do you think she's got a point?
Frankly, I'd be really surprised. I don't see this as I think the circumstances in which the election has happened are quite important. It's extraordinary that a Northern Ireland government could fall over an issue of maladministration rather than over the sort of deeper, more hurtful sectarian politics that is Northern Ireland's biggest problem. Although, of course, that did play a role as well. But nonetheless, I think it's quite remarkable that just as in a normal country, it's a question of administration, the implementation of policy that was the key to the calling of the election. However, the result I anticipate is not going to be terribly different from the results of last year's election. We just had the Assembly elected in 2016 in May, and this election comes only not even 10 months later. And I don't think the political situation has shifted very much. I think what Arlene Foster is trying to say is that if the DUP does not end up as the biggest single party, and Sinn Féin instead is the biggest single party in the new Assembly, then Michelle O'Neill will be the new First Minister, and the DUP candidate, presumably Arlene Foster, would be the Deputy First Minister. This really doesn't amount to an awful lot in terms of how the government would then be administered. The powers of the two are pretty much equal. Decisions must be made jointly between the two of them. Mm. Which one of them has got the slightly larger hat doesn't, practical terms, make a huge amount of difference. In symbolic terms, I guess it is quite important. It would be very upsetting for a lot of unionists to find that the head of government of Northern Ireland was now in Sinn Féin. I think it might be equally upsetting for Sinn Féin, which of course claims that Northern Ireland is an illegitimate entity, and for them to then discover that they are taking the lead in administering what they describe as an illegitimate entity might actually be a somewhat uncomfortable position for them. However, I think it's unlikely to transpire.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, what probability would you put on that? I mean, I would have assumed as an outsider that the DUP would always be the biggest party, but perhaps I suppose they could lose votes to the Ulster Unionists and let Sinn Féin in that way. Is that kind of what people are suggesting may happen?
Yeah, I mean, after 2016, of course, we're all being a bit careful about being too dogmatic about our predictions of what could and couldn't ever happen. Yeah. I think that's more or less right. The DUP could lose a quarter to a third of their votes and still, by my rank count, be the biggest single political party in Northern Ireland. There's a poll out today that shows them down a little bit. Frankly, I don't particularly trust Northern Irish opinion polls, but this isn't showing any hugely dramatic movement in their support. Personal support for Arlene Foster is down considerably, but that's a different matter. I think we will see a dip in the DUP votes. That would be normal enough. Whether we see a greater vote for significant increased vote for other parties or not, I'm not sure. I am getting reports from friends of mine who are on the ground doing the canvassing that there is a significant interest in participation from voters who are upset at the way things have happened and want to vote for anybody else. Whether they then actually do that is of course a different matter.
Old habits die hard, I'm sure. I mean, what do you make of Arlene Foster's future? You mentioned obviously this is an election that's around maladministration, and I suppose in a way one might consider that not a good thing that the maladministration happened, but a good thing that an election has been caused by a more, in inverted commas, normal event. But Arlene Foster remains as head of the DUP. I mean, is there pressure on her to stand down for the good of the party, let's say?
I mean, knowing the DUP, they'll judge her by the election results. And if there is significant swing against the DUP and they lose out on a number of... I mean, everybody will lose seats anyway, let's be clear, because there are only going to be 90 seats in the new Assembly rather than 108. That means that one seat in every six simply disappears. So the DUP starting on 38 seats could reasonably expect to lose six of those and still claim that they were level pegging. If it's significantly more than that, then I would have thought there'll be pressure on Arlene Foster to at the very least stand aside or possibly even to resign altogether. And there are young and hungry people in the DUP who are quite keen to replace her. It's unlike with Sinn Féin, where the sort of leadership evolution process was a bit obscure. The DUP increasingly is having its fights in the open. Mm. So I think that would probably turn out to be a rather quick process if push came to shove. Arlene Foster was elected unopposed as leader of the DUP just over a year ago. I suspect that there are people who feel that they didn't get a real chance, a real choice then, and would quite like to have a real choice now.
Mm. I mean, finally, let's talk about the future of Northern Ireland more generally. We can't ignore the Brexit vote. Obviously, has huge implications for the UK. I often say that maybe Northern Ireland, if not forgotten, is certainly the lesser told story of Brexit. Everyone talks about Scotland and what the SNP might do, but of course, Northern Ireland has other issues to consider, one of them being a hard border with the Republic. And Theresa May has spoken recently with the Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kelly, about how there should be a frictionless border, whatever that means. I mean, what do you think the potential implications of Brexit could be for Northern Ireland? I mean, should we be concerned?
Yes, it's pretty bad for both sides of the border, actually. The Irish Agriculture Ministry across the island is pretty much integrated at present. If you're now going to reimpose the customs barriers that were there for most of the 20th century on the border, which is a line drawn arbitrarily by 17th century surveyors who never thought that it was going to be used for this purpose, that's going to have a really significant impact on opportunity costs, transport considerations, the ease of doing business generally, and that's going to hit agriculture particularly, but it's going to hit all other parts of the economy as well. And, you know, sure, the common travel area, which means passport-free transit between Ireland and the UK, both across the border and across the Irish Sea, that presumably will remain. I don't think either side has an interest in changing it. But if Britain is leaving the customs union and Britain is leaving the single market, then that's going to increase friction on the border, no matter what Theresa May want to do. On top of that, let's bear in mind that other sectors of Northern Ireland, less visible perhaps, will also be badly hit by this. I'm thinking particularly of the universities, which already have difficulty in attracting external talent. Now, as with British universities more broadly, but perhaps particularly so in a far-off corner of the country, it's going to be difficult to attract international students because there are too many stories of them being deported. It's going to be difficult to attract international staff because their employment status is not secure. And most of all, it's going to be difficult to find partners to engage in international research consortia, which are the only things that are really getting serious money thrown at them these days. So it's very bad for the university sector in Northern Ireland, as well as pretty bad for the agricultural sector, and generally pretty poor for business. It's bad for the Republic as well, but at least there they have the benefit. They will be staying in the EU. Dublin will become the largest English-speaking city inside the European Union, and they're already preparing their offers to whatever they can get from financial services industries, which may be thinking again about their base in London.
Mm. And I guess one of the million-dollar question people will often ask when it comes to Northern Ireland is about the peace process itself. Now, I mean, one imagines that we're not going to return to the 70s and 80s anytime soon, certainly hope not. But do you think that the potential for a hard border on the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border, or indeed any sort of Brexit, runs the risk of inflaming the troubles again?
It is going to increase tension. We have to be really clear about that. The hardline supporters of Sinn Féin, who signed up to support the peace process in the 1990s, did so on the basis that this was within the European Union context, and that would mean that the border itself would simply wither away in significance, as it has done. And now we're in a situation where a Sinn Féin government, or a government with Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, is going to have to preside over the hardening of the border that it's committed to removing. And that's going to put them in a very difficult position vis-a-vis their own supporters. And I think it's not going to be easy to explain to the average voter in Tyrone or indeed in Fermanagh that this is all happening because of the way the regions of England happen to outvote London, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Gibraltar. That's not an argument that I'd like to be making. And it is going to, unless gains can be shown in other directions, and I'm thinking here particularly of the Irish language situation and of the dealing with the legacy of the past, unless gains can be shown in other directions, then it does put into question the general consensus on which the peace process has been built.
Let's hope Theresa May and James Brokenshaw are paying sufficient attention. Potentially ominous warning there. Nicholas White, thank you very much for your time.
Very glad to be here. Thank you, Kieran.
That was Nicholas White there, and a big thanks to Nicholas for taking the time to speak to me today. As I mentioned earlier in today's show, Northern Ireland is a subject very much close to my heart, and one that I hope isn't lost in the shuffle as we get on with the business of leaving the European Union. I think, as Nicholas warns at the end there, we shouldn't be complacent about the risks associated with a hard border between the north and south of Ireland. For the second part of today's show, I'm going to be joined by Leo Barassi to talk over the third in a series of Polling Matters opinion surveys. Leo, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Kieran.
So on this survey, what we did was we put six statements to the public about each of the main party leaders, Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn. And we asked people whether they agreed or disagreed with those statements. And people also had the option of saying neither or don't know. And those six statements, I'll paraphrase them briefly here, were that Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May are a strong leader, they would make a capable Prime Minister, or in Theresa May's case, that she is a capable Prime Minister. I understand what they stand for, they have a good chance of winning the next election, I like them, and also they understand the concerns of people like me. Now, that isn't the specific wording. You can find the specific wording in the opinion data tables, which will be published on their website in due course, as they always will be. But those are the six kind of subject areas that we looked at. And, I mean, Leo, one of the things that I think is a challenge with these sorts of questions is how do you look at the numbers, right? So what I've chosen to do, and people will see by the slides, is focus on the net agree-disagree score. But what do you think about that? Because I guess there's two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, you know, it's an easy way of condensing lots of information into one number, but on the other hand, what does that number mean?
Yeah, I think you've got to look at both. I think net is useful to get a sense of the general public mood and whether someone is being reviled or has got much wider support around them. But on the other hand, I think the raw number of how many people agree is a very important thing for a figure who is going to be facing an election. So, for example, if a party leader only has 30% agreeing with them on something that we think is going to be absolutely crucial for their electability, then that is really important. It doesn't really matter how many people disagree, because we're going to be looking at that 30% and wondering if that's a cap of how many they can get, for example.
Yeah. So let's look at some of these numbers. And I mentioned earlier, both on Twitter but also on the show, that these numbers were taken over the last weekend, where Theresa May had some pretty bad headlines, I thought. You know, lots of protests against Donald Trump. She was very much guilty by association, having visited him a few days before. And the upshot of these numbers is that Theresa May wallops Jeremy Corbyn on every conceivable metric. So the best way, I think, to look at this from an audio perspective is to look at the net ratings. So this is taking the percentage that disagree and subtracting that from the percentage that agree with a statement and using that plus or minus figure to understand whether the scores are good or bad. And obviously, a plus figure is good, negative figure is bad. So let's go through these. So, Theresa May is a strong leader, plus 23. Jeremy Corbyn is a strong leader, minus 44. Theresa May is a capable Prime Minister, plus 26. Jeremy Corbyn would make a capable Prime Minister, minus 42. So these are numbers, Leo, that are very much kind of hard metrics around leadership, aren't they? And Theresa May seems to be extremely strong versus Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. I think these two metrics are ones that the term is hygiene factors. And I'd say they're hygiene factors for May but not for Corbyn. So a Tory Prime Minister has to be strong and has to be capable. That's sort of priced in, that they've got to be, you know, it's sort of it's why people vote for Tories. It's not so much why Labour needs what makes Labour leaders popular, but I mean the point is Labour have to be in the game here. You know, May is sort of where she needs to be. Plus 23, plus 26. That's great. Those are really good numbers. In a way, they're kind of what you'd expect for a Tory Prime Minister who's doing well. And you'd probably expect them to be ahead of the Labour leader, but gap's that big, so on the raw numbers, that's 14% and 16% respectively saying that Corbyn is strong and Corbyn is capable. I mean, those are really, really low, even taking into account that these are things that are sort of the extras for a Labour leader.
Yeah, 58% disagree that Jeremy Corbyn is a strong leader, and 58% disagree that he would make a capable Prime Minister. Hopefully these kind of concepts of nets are so okay for some people. Okay, bad start for Jeremy Corbyn. So let's move on to some of the softer metrics, if you like. So I understand what she stands for, or I understand what he stands for. Theresa May, plus 16. Jeremy Corbyn, minus 5. And also, I understand the concerns of people like me. Theresa May, minus 4. Jeremy Corbyn, minus 20. So weaker numbers, I guess, for Theresa May, particularly understanding the concerns of people like me, but I guess, again, not great for Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, this is the flip side. This is the other kind of hygiene factors. These are ones that people expect a Labour leader to understand what they stand for and care about the concerns of people like me. There are things that Labour leaders have to have but don't win them elections. And it's sort of the opposite for Tories. If a Tory can be strong and capable but also be seen to understand the concerns of people like me, that's what puts them into the territory where they're unbeatable. So May's numbers are looking great. Minus 5 or so isn't brilliant, but it's not too bad for a Tory leader, Tory Prime Minister. But the Corbyn numbers are really scary. Only 9% are strongly agreeing that they understand what Corbyn stands for. Now, I mean, that was very much his selling point. I mean, the leadership campaigns, both of them, were very much centred around the idea that he is a moral crusader. So it's pretty clear that his message isn't getting across, and given that's a hygiene issue for Labour leaders, that's really worrying.
Mm. And the last couple has a good chance of leading the Conservatives or Labour to victory at the next general election. So obviously for Theresa May, we're asking about the Conservatives, and Jeremy Corbyn, we're asking about Labour. Just to be clear, so Theresa May, plus 32, Jeremy Corbyn, minus 48. And just to put those Jeremy Corbyn numbers in perspective, 60% of those polled disagreed that he has a good chance of winning the next election. So that is actually, I believe, if my my mental arithmetic is good enough, a 80-point difference if you were to net the nets, if that's such a thing that you should do. We'll come on to that in a minute, Leo, but obviously it's pretty clear what the message is there. But the one that really struck me, actually, which I suspect won't be the headline figure from this poll, was I like Theresa May, or I like Jeremy Corbyn. Theresa May's number here was plus 9, and Jeremy Corbyn's number was minus 24. So, for example, 37% agreed that they liked Theresa May, 28% disagreed that they liked Theresa May, and obviously heavily split on party lines, whereas 22% agreed that they liked Jeremy Corbyn, 46% disagreed. This was a number that struck me the most, personally, because this survey was taken over the weekend when Theresa May was having very bad headlines because she was identified strongly with Donald Trump and all the things that he was doing, because she'd been in the White House, you know, a few days earlier. It's not an unreasonable connection to make. And yet, she's more popular, she's more liked than the Labour leader. And that's a real problem, I think, for the Labour Party.
So I think I disagree with you a bit there. I think to my mind, you're overinterpreting how much people are going to be paying attention to the news and how much we should expect May's closeness to Trump to be influencing people's views of her. I reckon most people will have probably heard about the Trump protests. I think that's hard to miss. If they've heard of May's connection with her, I think most people will just be thinking, well, she's Prime Minister. Of course she's going to go and meet the US President. And of course she's going to try and have a good relationship with him. I think over time that could be a problem with her, but I'm not convinced that we're there yet. I think the Corbyn numbers are genuinely surprising to me. Given that his numbers were net so low, I'd assume that there was a lot of people just not having an opinion, but 46% disagreeing that they like him, that's genuinely surprising. I mean, it's not something that I think I hear very often, the suggestion that he's dislikable. I think certainly very much within political circles there's a sort of small debate that he's not as nice as he seems to be, but I think you've got to be a bit of a politics watcher to get that. So that surprised me.
I suppose, to be a pedant, and I would never accuse you of doing that, Leo, but this is an agree-disagree scale on liking someone. So you could argue that actually what people are saying there is, well, I don't not like them, but I just don't like them.
Yeah.
So that doesn't 46% saying disagree with that doesn't necessarily mean they dislike him actively. It just maybe means that they say, well, no. But then at the same time, if that was the case, I'm not sure why they wouldn't put a neutral, so like a neither. So if they didn't really, so if they were saying I don't dislike him but I don't like him, why don't they put the middle score rather than this? I don't know. That's something for people to argue over the semantics of, I suppose. But a final poll finding, I guess, before we move on to the wider landscape. One of the numbers that I picked out was looking at what Labour voters thought of Jeremy Corbyn and what Conservative voters thought of Theresa May. I did the same thing again. I looked at the net ratings. Theresa May's are astonishingly high. I mean, you can barely get 5% of Tory voters to disagree with any of those statements about her. She is extremely popular on the British centre-right. And this is Conservative voters. This doesn't even factor in people that maybe begrudgingly like her elsewhere. So I won't go through them all, but for example, for a strong leader, she has a net rating of plus 80 amongst Conservative voters. So very much the new Iron Lady there. Jeremy Corbyn's, at least for them, I guess, Jeremy Corbyn's numbers are a bit more interchangeable. So he gets scores of plus 40 for things like, I understand what they stand for. This is amongst Labour voters. I like him. He understands the concerns of people like me. Not as strong as Theresa May's getting on those scores amongst Conservative voters, but, you know, convincing numbers nonetheless. He gets plus 20 amongst Labour voters for would make a capable Prime Minister, so at least it's positive, but that's versus plus 86 Theresa May gets amongst Conservative voters for being a capable Prime Minister. And he gets a plus 7 on being a strong leader, so certainly doubts there amongst Labour Party supporters on that. And he gets a minus 3 amongst Labour voters for having a good chance of leading the Labour Party to a victory at the next general election. So what we're picking up there is what we've seen a lot of in some of the YouGov polling of Labour members, which is I kind of support him, but I'm not sure he can win. Although this is maybe less pronounced amongst Labour voters than it would be amongst Labour members. So I guess if there's a message that people should take away from my perspective, and there's lots of numbers we're going to be posting online here that people can really delve into, I think the fact that the strength of support for Theresa May amongst Conservatives being so strong compared to real lukewarm support amongst Labour voters is a real story here.
Yeah, I think so. It feels like the Tories' numbers are quite firm and Labour's numbers are potentially quite soft. And for me, that comes back to only 25% of people saying that Corbyn, that they agree Corbyn cares about the concerns of people like them, or understands the concerns of people like them. That it sort of feels 25% might be the sort of territory that Labour is beginning to head towards in its poll rating with some of the stuff that we're seeing here.
Mm. We've only got two or three minutes left, but I mean, for the benefit of the listeners, we're going to be tweeting out some images of those poll findings this evening. This is Wednesday, and the full data tables will be available on Opinion's website in the coming days. So, I mean, watch your space for those of you that want to really trawl the cross breaks and the data tables and that sort of thing. And you know, certainly do sort of fire us any questions that you want. But not great reading for the Labour Party. Let's touch briefly on the wider landscape, Leo, politically before we close. I suppose we've got the Article 50 debate going through Parliament. I've always found it quite hard to get motivated for this, to be honest, because I feel like it's just going to pass. But, I mean, you've been looking at some numbers, I think it was from YouGov, but also just some of the situations going on in the Labour Party, and you maybe think it's a bit different?
Yeah, I mean, so those YouGov numbers you mentioned are interesting. They're from a YouGov Open Britain poll, and I'd encourage people to look at it. It's actually only three questions, and I won't go through the numbers, but essentially the headline from it is public opinion is much more than I had thought in favour of Parliament having the final say and being prepared for Parliament to send the government back to Brussels to renegotiate if the deal isn't good enough first time, rather than just leaving the EU without a deal, which surprised me. It suggested that already, even in the context of the public clearly wanting Britain to just get on with it and leave, that there is more willingness to give Parliament authority than I'd expected. And I sort of think on that line, where Corbyn is potentially able to take the party is interesting. It sort of feels that he can go in a direction that tackles those weak numbers he's got on being strong and being capable, and sort of say I'm a stern guardian or stern teacher, sort of correcting the government and making sure that it's going in the right direction. I'm going to support Article 50, but only with all these provisos and these amendments. And clearly, Labour is putting down some amendments, and you know that seems to be the route that he's going down. Or he can work in the other direction and say, I'm a moral crusader. I'm going to, you know, back up those numbers on understand what I stand for and concerns people like me, and you know, fight radically against the government, take an oppositionist stance, which I think is clearly the kind of thing that a lot of members want him to do. The difficulty at the moment is, I think it's not clear which of those paths he's really going down. It sort of feels like a half-hearted support for Article 50 without doing the things that sort of shows him to be strong. And I think those YouGov numbers suggest that there is scope for Labour to really hold the government's feet to the fire, and the public are willing to have Parliament and the Labour opposition insisting that the government does do the negotiations in the national interest. So it sort of feels that there is space there, and instinctively it does seem to be the direction that Corbyn is taking the party. But it's not an automatic thing. It's not just a matter of supporting Article 50 and this stuff happens. There's a lot more work that has to go along with it.
There is, and also I think there is a fundamental fact which, you know, all of these things will end up meeting the fact that Theresa May is much more popular and much more respected as a leader than Jeremy Corbyn. So when it comes to the Brexit deal, I have a suspicion if she says this is the best deal we can get, and I'm telling you this because I'm Theresa May, I just wonder whether who is it that's going to force her to go back
right,
to
but
Brussels?
But you create your own you create your own space for this. You pick up on five or six or however many, but not 100 things, and you say, right, these are the things we're going to fight on and we're going to embarrass the government on, and you keep on coming up and coming back to them on the stuff that you say this is going wrong and we're going to hold the government to account on it, and you know, that undermines their credibility.
But then whilst Labour has resignation after resignation from the front bench and that sort of thing, that's not going to help Corbyn on some of these numbers like strong leader, is it?
No, and it's clearly been badly handled. I think there would have been no loss in making it a free vote. I think by whipping it, he's probably ended up in the worst of both worlds. I don't think anyone would have cared or looked back in 6 months' time if Labour had made it a free vote and the few had voted in against Article 50. But that ship has sailed now. They've got to move on.
Well, something we'll be picking up on in future episodes of the podcast. And that's all we've got time for on this week's show. A bumper edition this week with the interview of Nicholas White and also us unveiling our third poll on the leadership ratings. Do let us know what you think. If you like what you hear on the show, please share us with other people. Give our Facebook page a like. Subscribe on iTunes and other apps on Android. And generally, just do anything you can to get the show out there. It would be very much appreciated. And you know, if you are on iTunes and places like that, do give us ideally a nice review and rating too. But that is, as I say, all we've got time for. A big thank you to Leo for joining me again today, and also obviously for Nicholas White earlier, and for Opinium for providing some of the latest polling data for us to analyse. Stay tuned for more episodes in the coming weeks, and thanks for listening.